Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Financial District. I am Jim Copeland, Senior Director of the Club. We also welcome the listeners of WMEF-FM in Fort Kent, Maine, one of more than 225 stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, to introduce tonight's speaker, it is my pleasure to turn the podium over to Eric Tarloff. Mr. Tarloff, who became known as a longtime Washington insider after just 3 years of residence in the Capitol, is an Emmy-nominated screenwriter and the author of the 1998 novel FaceTime. His newest novel, The Man Who Wrote the Book, will be published next year. Mr. Tarloff.
Thank you, Jim. There are journalists, one thinks of A.J. Liebling writing about boxing, for example, or Roger Angel on the subject of baseball, who are so much more interesting than what they write about that it's fair to say they ennoble their subjects simply by the quality of their attention. The same applies in spades to Elizabeth Drew. For over 20 years, she's been, hands down, the best political reporter in Washington. Her regular appearances in The New Yorker taught a whole generation how to deconstruct politics. And since leaving that magazine, she has written books that, taken together, qualify as the definitive account of Washington in the Clinton years. Now, the people she writes about are undeniably important. The decisions they make affect all our lives in profound and pervasive ways. But in terms of intellectual breadth and intellect and analytical seriousness, she leaves the majority of them in the dust. But although many of them are clownish incompetence, she insists on taking them seriously. She knows politics isn't merely a game, and the things these people do have far-reaching consequences. Not that she's some sort of knee-jerk Jeremiah. She loves politics and is generous to its practitioners. She has written glowing accounts of John Culver in her book, Senator, of Paul Sarbanes in her description of the 1974 impeachment deliberations of the House Judiciary Committee. And in her latest book, The Corruption of American Politics, she gives Fred Thompson of Tennessee his due. But in the main, most American citizens could only wish that their elected representatives took their responsibilities as seriously as Elizabeth Drew does. And God knows they ought to, not merely because there are representatives and because the health of the republic depends on it, but also for their own self-protection. They shouldn't forget that Elizabeth Drew is watching. So, ladies and gentlemen of the Commonwealth Club, please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Drew.
In the interest of true disclosure, which Washington pretends to pay a lot of attention to, I should tell you that after Eric and his wife, Laura Tyson, came to Washington, we became friends. So I'd like to think he's being objective, but I think you should know that. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I hope you realize that Eric's list of people that I have treated favorably was bipartisan. I give a lot of thought to, even if there's a book behind it, what I want to focus on when I give a speech. And sometimes I don't guess right. There was a time, and you know how long ago, when I get to the story, when I was supposed to give a speech in Richmond, Virginia, to a women's group, and I had the flu. And I called a mentor of mine, and I said, what am I going to do? I have to go to Richmond. I have to give the speech, and I'm so sick. I can't even think about it. And he said, that's all right, dear. It was okay then to do that. And he said, you just get up and talk about the things that you know best. And we agreed that the things that I knew best were my then-recent experiences in covering Watergate and the near-impeachment of President Nixon. It was my first big series in The New Yorker and my first book. So I was having lunch with the ladies in charge of this event beforehand, and one of them, apropos of absolutely nothing, said, We had Senator Ervin last year, and thank God he didn't talk about Watergate. Nobody wants to hear another word about it. So stomach sinking and brow getting ever damper. I asked her something that I really had meant to check out, and I usually do, but in my sorry state I had not. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, but who is the congressman from this area? And she drew herself up, and she looked down at me, and she said, my husband. Well, I'm still doing what I'm doing. Her husband is not, so these things balance out. I understand my friend George Stephanopoulos was here not terribly long ago. I'm not name-dropping because I knew George when he was nobody. He was an aide on Capitol Hill, a very bright aide to Dick Gephardt in the House, and some of us discovered him. Like, it isn't just that you talk to the bigwigs, the ones who are elected, but you're constantly looking out for interesting and knowledgeable staff people who will be good sources. And George fit those qualifications, aside from which he was a lot of fun to talk to. Well, as you know, he ended up in the White House. And when my first book about, my only book really on the Clinton administration per se, was coming out in 1994, I wasn't feeling very brave, and so I waited till the very last minute, till the books were in the store, sent my assistant over to hand them out, and went out to lunch. The next day, George called me, and he said, well, Elizabeth, I'm halfway through the book. They do put priority on these things. And he said, it seems accurate and it seems fair, but I have a huge bone to pick with you. And I said, well, George, what's that? What's wrong? He said, what do you mean I'm no movie star? And since I had known him, I hadn't really quite noticed what people began to notice. And so I was writing about the fact that he had become, somewhat surprisingly, a national heartthrob. And I said, he's attractive enough, but he's no movie star. Well, so I had been prepared for various forms of criticism, but not that precise one. So I fumbled my way through, and I thought that night, Drew, you just didn't do well enough at all. And so I sent George a fax to be put on his desk the next morning. And I said, dear George, I thought you should know that there are those of us who are attracted to your mind. The book I most recently published was born of my thinking about how Washington had changed while I had been there and what I had seen, but also what had happened that made people so unhappy about our government. I mean, what really had happened? I mean, we all know the complaints that it's too partisan, it's uncivil, that it's irrelevant, which is quite wrong. But what was it that had changed? What was beneath the surface of all this? And I took as my point of departure 1974, not because that made a convenient 25 years, but that was a time of a lot of hope. President Nixon had been run out of office. It was a much closer call than a lot of people think. If there had not been these pieces of tape, I really can't say for sure that he would have had to leave office. But people felt the system worked. 75 so-called Watergate babies were elected to the House on platforms of opening up the system and reform. And then the third thing was the passage of a quite comprehensive, historically thorough campaign finance reform act, pretty much based on the scandals of the 1972 election, particularly the Nixon campaign, which now look like a Tea Party. So where are we now? You've heard the figures about low turnout. In 96, the turnout was the lowest since 1924. In 98, the off-year election, lowest off-year since 1942. and the Campaign Finance Reform Act has been thoroughly destroyed. Of course, I keep saying it's dead, and something comes along to make it even deader. What happened? Well, I did this based on my own recollections, but an awful lot of interviewing of thoughtful people, people on both sides, lobbyists, members of Congress, people who aren't part of it but are wise observers. And I have to tell you that my blunt but I think well-founded assessment is the quality of our politicians has declined. This is only one of the things that happened, but it's a very important piece of what happened, and you don't much read about it. In general, this is in general, the newer members are less grounded in issues, less interested in issues, less interested in governing. They are more driven by, as is much of the rest of the society, careerism. Just getting there is enough. Being there is enough. A political consultant who, after all, makes a living off these people said to me, we've always had lunkheads and we had exotica, but they were talented. They used to have ideas. And he said, now you have a whole set of politicians whose guiding idea is, where's my pollster? And then he went on to say, and then, whether or not they've achieved anything in the House, if they can get the money and they can get the pollster, they go on to the Senate, whether there's anything to recommend them or not. He said, in the old days, you had to have some convictions. Today we have an interesting term, hyper-democracy, based on money and polls. If you can get the money, you get the pollster, it can propel you into office and then to the Senate, because that's the next step. Now, this is not a theoretical matter. It has changed the very nature of the House and the Senate, their cultures and how they work and how they think. It is now the case that nearly 50% of the Senate are previous House members who have brought with them the more fractious and partisan and near-term ways of thinking that are more were more prevalent in the House than in the Senate. A lot of people attribute this change in the tone of our politics to Newt Gingrich. And while I certainly have had my criticisms of Gingrich, this is really a bipartisan development. I had a Democratic senator, a middle-aged man, say to me one day in despair, there are just too many former House members around here. We just can't get anything done. One part of this is, but a very important part of this, is short-term thinking. Now, you've heard a lot about how presidents, and particularly the current one, use pollsters. You haven't heard a lot about, but the same thing is now going on Capitol Hill and very much affecting how they work. Now, some of my best friends are pollsters and consultants, and many of them are very interesting and very thoughtful people, and I like to talk to them and hear what they have to say about what's going on. But their job is to get their client reelected. Their job is not to think about the long-term future and progress of the country. It is not to address the national agenda. It is to advise their clients on what position it's a good idea to take for the next election. It's not just their own clients. They come and address the party caucuses in the House and the Senate. And, of course, in the end, it's the members themselves who choose to follow that advice and conduct themselves in a certain way. So increasingly, quite markedly, the emphasis has become more on positioning than on governing. This is not a theoretical matter. In July, the Senate considered HMO reform. I think we can all agree this is an issue of grave concern, of great importance to millions and millions of Americans. And what happened? Both parties, were paying a lot of attention to who their main contributors were, but B, they were positioning themselves for the next election. There was a compromise at hand, but that was rebuffed. That wasn't what they wanted to do. They wanted to have an issue in the election. So they passed a bill on a party line vote that everybody understood that the president would veto. Nothing was accomplished in terms of the national interest. The emphasis is on short term rather than long, and the public pays a big price for this. It's this very reason that expectations are low, that the Medicare problem will be resolved before the election, or the Social Security problem before the election. Now, as I understand it, after the election, there'll be another election. So one of these days, maybe they will feel forced to face up and address national issues. And in fact, if they get enough criticism along these lines, they'll say, oh, the polls are telling us to solve the problem, so we'll do that. I mean, I've heard that in the past. Now, this is not to be taken as nostalgia for the old days. There were things that were good about the old days, and there were things that were not so good. It was a much more closed and secret process. Women and minorities were virtually locked out of electoral politics. But there was a core of people who saw it as their role to work across the aisles and solve the problems. Yes, we had our exotica. Yes, Wilbur Mills of Arkansas, the famous chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, landed up in the tidal basin with a stripper named Fanny Fox. But Wilbur Mills knew how to fix Social Security and get it through. He knew how to get the Medicare program started. I could go on with examples like this. We've also had an exodus in the last 6 years, I would say, mainly of people in the center on both parties, particularly in the Senate, but also in the House. This is for a number of reasons. One of them, the fundraising problems, which I shall get to. So there is less of a center, there is less of an inclination to work across the aisles and get things done. This was a drain that occurred in both parties, whether it was William Cohen, who's now the Secretary of Defense, Sam Nunn, who's off doing various things. Those were the kinds of people who worked across the aisles, and there used to be people you probably weren't all that aware of then, and they are gone. There's also been a big change in Washington since I've been there. I think maybe one of JFK's greatest contributions to national life was to get across the idea that working for the government was a glorious and noble cause. And I knew people who came to town just out of the sheer excitement of working for not just in the White House, but agencies that weren't that glamorous because it now aren't considered that glamorous because it was just a wonderful thing to do. I used to know people who signed on to presidential campaigns because they desperately believed in the person and thought they should be president. Now there's a lot more calculation. Who is likely to win? Land me in the White House? Coming to Washington or taking jobs in Washington that are going to lead to very lucrative careers. Washington has become a money culture. It used to be that New York was the money culture. Washington was the government culture. But I would say the getting and acquiring of money, whether it is in politics or outside of politics, earning it off the politicians, is now the predominant culture in Washington. You see the buildings rising along K Street and L Street and M Street filled with lobbyists. Now, I have nothing against lobbyists, but it's changed the very nature of Washington. The consultants thrive on controversy and conflict, and if there isn't enough, they sometimes dream it up. I have in my book an example of a very candid lobbyist who told me a story about an issue that really wasn't an issue, but he and some other people made it into an issue. And then people had to pay them to resolve the issue. And, you know, they lived happily ever after. He said, but really, it was like the Wizard of Oz. Behind the curtain, there was just me and a bell and a whistle making the whole thing up. They do this on Capitol Hill as well. It's all, of course, about access. If you have access, you can sell your access. It's pretty crude sounding, but that's how it works. There are whole lobby firms set up because so-and-so can get to a certain very important member of Congress, really. And businesses have enough money to say, well, you know, we better bring that person aboard because he can help us get to so-and-so. I have some stories about that. There's also a whole new phenomenon in Washington of the charitable dinner. It sounds good. But what really goes on here, you know, they did pass a law rule in the House and the Senate that you really can't buy, a lobbyist really can't buy a member of Congress a lavish dinner anymore. And this has hurt the restaurant business, of course. But beyond that, this makes these people a little anxious that they aren't getting enough access. They can't have these long evenings, you know, where they can really talk to these guys. So we have the charitable dinner where the member of Congress, more likely the member of Congress's wife, is sponsoring the dinner for the something or other Good Works Association. And the member of Congress or the senator puts the arm on the lobbyists, the government contractors, and said, surely you want to be there. And for $10,000, you can have a table, and it's a charitable deduction. And I said to a lobbyist who said, we're really rather sick of this, well, why do you go? He said, because it's understood that the congressman or senator will get his pals there, and we can have a warm and fuzzy evening like we can't have anymore under the new rules. There is the dedication of chairs in people's names, often when they retire, but even while they're still there. There is a chair being dedicated in the name of Trent Lott, who is, as you know, the majority leader of the Senate. And so if there's a dinner to raise money for this chair, and you're a lobbyist and you want to talk to Trent Lott, chances are that you go. There are other very imaginative ways now of getting around these things. And speaking of imagination, it's not quite germane to what I was just saying, but I have to tell you, one of the favorite stories I've seen in a while was in the papers last week. This has to do also with not wanting to solve hard problems. And that is the Congress is facing a big problem in meeting what are called budget caps. You know, they don't speak English in Washington. Budget caps are the ceilings put on spending on different areas of government so that they can meet the alleged balanced budget. And so what to do? Because politically making the cuts to meet those budget caps would be very politically risky and difficult. I've got an idea, said Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania. We'll make a year 13 months long. So they will shell out 13 months' worth of money within a year. Now, I don't know what happens to the next year, whether it's 11 months or quite how they carry 14, okay. Just keep going. But the overwhelming thing that has happened to our government is what has happened to the role of money in politics. Now, my problem with the area, it's not just my problem, it's a whole lot of people's problem, is not people say, oh, you're against money in politics. That's not it. The troubling aspects of what is going on is the ever-escalating arms race. Every time they have to raise more than the last time and more than they perceive some opponent might raise, and on it goes. And then even that isn't all of it. It's what do they have to do to raise the money, and what do they do after they get the money? To raise the money, well, let me give you an example. Last year, Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, who had been in the Senate two terms, said, I'm not going to run again. I just don't want to have to raise all that money. He said, this was mid-1998, he said, if I run again, I would have to raise $5,000 every working day between now and Election Day 2000. Now, because of the limits, $1,000 a person, that's maybe 20 calls to get the $5,000. And it has become so burdensome that this is driving a number of people out of politics, and I think it's also keeping a number of good people from wanting to get in it. The campaign finance law has been shot to death, I think. I wrote a book in the New Yorker in 1982, and it came out in 1983. And it was the first lay treatment of all this, and I discovered this thing called soft money. Soft money, you hear a lot about it, is otherwise illegal money, money that you can't give directly to a candidate, but you can give it to the parties in the name of nice party-building activities, get out the vote drives, balloons, banners, all that sort of thing. Well, you probably know by now what happens to this soft money is it goes to the parties and is basically used to make issue ads. I'm making quote marks for those listening on the radio. Issue ads which are supposedly educating the public on an issue, but quite obviously and blatantly are for or against the election of a certain candidate. These are done through a wide, stretched reading of a Supreme Court decision. And it has changed politics dramatically. I talked to some senators who said I didn't used to be for campaign finance reform, but these ads were coming into my district. I didn't know from whom. I lost control of the issues in my campaign, and we have to do something about it. The politics of campaign finance reform have changed. For nearly 2 years now, I have been against the Washington wisdom, which I frequently am, which says that, A, the public doesn't care, and, B, nothing will happen. Congress isn't going to do anything about it. In fact, in 1998, we had real majorities for significant reform in the House and the Senate. The House passed a bill. They passed it again last week by an even wider margin with 54 Republicans defying their leadership, which is not something you do lightly. There is a majority in the Senate, but there's this little problem with the filibuster. People don't have the guts to really filibuster anymore. I mean, they don't talk all night and sleep on cots in a room nearby. It's no fun. They just threaten to filibuster, say, okay, I'm filibustering. Everybody says, oh, okay. And then the problem becomes to get 60 votes to cut off the filibuster. And campaign finance reform, at the last year at least, did not have 60 votes behind it. Senator McCain has revised his proposal, hoping to pick up more votes, but I think that the jury's out on whether that's going to succeed. The other reason I think it's moving, the movement behind it is growing. You have two quite credible presidential candidates making it a centerpiece of their campaigns. Neither Senator Bradley and Senator McCain, neither of them is a Don Quixote. They realize, A, they understand the substance of the problem, but they also realize that people are a lot more bothered about it than the Washington wiseacres think. There have been times when the public has had a chance to register its own opinion on this, and each time they have registered strongly for reform. Inevitably, Senator McCain's political advisor said to him early this year, John, you can't possibly want to make campaign finance reform one of your issues. That's crazy. Republican mainstream primary voters will kill you. They hate it. And so they commissioned a poll, and it came back that 60% of these mainstream Republicans felt that there really had to be significant change in the finance system. And if you want the best sources on this, I recently met a very important fundraiser for George W. Bush. I happen to already know someone who's a major fundraiser for Al Gore. And both of them have said to me, the system is just awful, and it has to change. Well, these people know how it works. Does it buy votes? You never can be sure. But even a senator who is terribly straight said to me, this was Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, and as straight a shooter as they come, and so straight that he actually said to me, you know, when I take money from a contributor and then I cast a vote of interest to that contributor, I can't help but think, am I going to get money the next time? Now, he didn't say I vote that way, but at a minimum, it affects the thinking. And, of course, everybody is represented, but the people. Senator McCain tells the story, and I wrote about it, of the Telecommunications Act of 1995. He knows because he's chairman of the Commerce Committee. And it was a jamboree for the consultant and lobbyists. I mean, did they ever clean up on this thing? And everybody, all the interests were at the table, all the interests except the consumers. And they carved up the new legislation, so each of the interests got something, except the public did not. Rates have gone up. Service hasn't improved, as I think everybody knows. So at a minimum, there's something quite askew. I think something is going to break through one of these days and pass. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky is the most effective opponent of campaign finance reform, and nothing is more guaranteed to cow other senators than one who gets up there and wraps himself in the toga of constitutional scholar. Now, a few of them know that what he's saying is bogus, but not very many are ready to take him on. But in fact, I'll just give you this and then refer you to chapter 3 of the book, which I sweated blood over, but I'm very proud of, where I really deconstruct the First Amendment argument, at least as it pertains to campaign financing. And you will hear, the Senate will take up the bill next month. You will hear him say, you hear him say now. And unfortunately, you hear journalists who don't do their homework say, well, the Supreme Court said money equals speech. In other words, the raising, contributing, and spending of money is the equivalent of the of freedom of speech guaranteed by the First Amendment. I've got news for you. No, it didn't. It didn't say that. It said that there are competing values, the First Amendment right to free speech and clean elections. And sometimes one should prevail and sometimes the other should prevail. It also said some things that really, if read carefully, suggest that these issue ads, these so-called issue ads, are not constitutionally protected speech. I just want to tell you that the book is not a complete downer, and I don't want you to feel down, because I end up talking about the fact that there really are things citizens can do that would have an impact and change things. I think this is terribly underly understood, if I could put it that way. Because these people are much more responsive to what they think the public, and particularly their own constituents, think than most people understand. They have town meetings quite often, and I have heard members of Congress say, you know, at my town meeting last weekend, five people raised the subject of X. Or he'll say, Sam was telling me about his town meeting, and three people really gave him a hard time about why. They talk about the town meetings among themselves. What happened at yours? What did you hear? What's going on? Now, they know these are the most vocal constituents, but they're the ones they worry the most about. So I tell, go to the town meetings. Tell them off. Tell them what you want. Tell them what you want changed. I was on a panel with a senator last year who said, you know, if I get 300 calls on an issue, that's a lot of calls. And that, of course, does not mean the organized calls, which they can detect at once. Well, 300 calls on an important issue from a state is not a lot of calls. Call them up. Let them know what you think. I feel strongly that people who do not vote don't really have a right to complain because they have checked out. That those who say Washington is irrelevant really don't know what's going on. Every day, decisions are made that affect citizens' daily lives, whether it's the air you breathe, the water you drink, the safety of the food you eat, the soundness of the bank where you put your money, the financial markets. I could go on and on and on. To some extent, the quality of your children's schools, where your tax money goes, who gets it and who doesn't, and the list is quite long. And so if you think Washington is irrelevant, you've actually checked out on the place that makes a great many decisions that affect your lives. If people turned out more to vote, but beyond that, if you think the turnout in November is bad, think of what it is in the primaries. I mean, it's virtually non-existent. And then people get to November and they say, how did we end up with these two people? Well, because you weren't paying attention when they were decided. I'm not saying that, heaven can be created on Capitol Hill, but I am saying that citizens can have much more of an impact than they think. If you want the money system changed, there are all kinds of ways to register opinion. And I think my final message is that politicians will probably never be as good as we would like them to be, but they'll be no better than we demand that they be. Thank you. I hope you sorted those questions out well.
Brilliant.
Okay.
I think there are more questions than there are people in the audience, so we're going to have a hard time getting to them. But I've been doing a masterly job of organizing them. There's a lot of repetition in the question, so if yours isn't asked in your words, don't think it's a personal slight. I swear to God it isn't. Common Cause is sponsoring a workshop on October 16th in the East Bay on public financing of elections called The Time Is Now. Do you think there can be meaningful campaign finance reform without public financing?
I think public financing is the ultimate goal. And I think it's very important that some people and some groups are putting it on the agenda. This would not be full government financing of candidates' campaigns. It's a voluntary system where there would be a matching of contributions of a certain size that would ease the pressure somewhat. Now, when I've talked about this sometimes on radio programs, back come the telephone calls. There's no question. The buttons all light up. Ms. Drew, why should I pay for a politician's campaign? To which the answer is you're paying mightily now for the current system in an unfair tax system, in unnecessary, undeserved subsidies to those who give more money than you can give, and on the list goes. I didn't mention that campaign finance reform has a very interesting new constituency, and that's business. Not all of business by any means. It's divided. But in the last election, a number of corporations said, we're getting out of the soft money business. It's a bottomless pit. It's unaccountable money. No matter how much we give, they hit us up for more. We're out. Now, something called the Committee for Economic Development, which is a number of very powerful business people and economists, have come out with their own agenda, which has voluntary, partial public financing of congressional elections on it. I don't think it's going to happen real soon, but I think it's very important that it be out there as something that people discuss and get used to the idea.
In the pantheon of presidents, where does President Clinton stand in achieving the best for the national interest, both at home and abroad?
Uh-oh.
I was hoping you'd get this one.
You promised not to tell your wife what I said. I describe, actually, the Clinton presidency in the book. I must tell you, when I talk about what's happened to our politics and people's disaffection, that this book was thought up and was being written well before any of us had heard of a certain Monica. The way I describe the Clinton presidency is of failed possibilities. Bill Clinton is one of the smartest people I have ever met, not to say one of the smartest presidents. He is just a brilliant man. And his mind absorbs all sorts of material, and he puts it together, and he thinks it through. And I'm one of the few people in the universe who would have said, at least people who didn't work for him, would have said and did say that he had a vision when he came to office. And I heard him, I hung around a lot when I was working on that book. And I heard him talk about it in small groups, big speeches, and so on. The vision was a very important one, and that was a lifelong opportunity, that people would always have opportunity to get more education and more training as the economy was changing under the pressures of the global economy. It was a very fine vision. But something happened. In 1994, the Republicans took over the House for the first time in 40 years. Mrs. Clinton's health care plan had gone down in flames, which was one of the issues in 94. And I think Clinton lost his confidence. And he didn't think big anymore. And he brought in the consultant, Dick Morris, whom you've all heard about. I've described him in print as a political cross-dresser. I mean, he's worked for Trent Lott and Jesse Helms. I mean, he doesn't mind. And Clinton became convinced to play it safe and come up for these little mini-programs that are all right, you know, night basketball and school uniforms and things like that. But there was no great vision and leadership for the country. And I think he had been capable of it, and he kind of lost it. And I think that's too bad.
If you were Vice President Gore, would you want President Clinton to campaign actively for you in the 2000 campaign?
No.
That's it? What is your opinion of Trent Lott?
Can I go back to the last question? Trent Lott is almost an archetype of what I was talking about in the speech. He's a former House member, a former House leader. He was part of Gingrich's gang. This was before they took over in 94. He was already in the Senate. He is not a big thinker or big strategist. He deals in tactics. He brought with him, the fractiousness and deeper partisanship of the House. But I have to say that he's not the only person in the Senate who is that way. There are Democrats who are the same way. They just don't seem to have the same power. Also, Lott is under a lot of pressure from newer arrivals who all the more bring pressure on him to enforce party discipline, to stick to whatever the party program is, if there is one. He's not really a free man. I mean, I don't lose sleep over him, but he is in a more difficult position than many people understand. But he's not a big thinker. I think, again, if the Congress gets enough pressure from the public, would you stop positioning and get some things done, they'll say, that's a good idea, let's do that.
Pollsters are identified as Democrat or Republican. Does the fact that they're affiliated with the party give them less credibility since there's an automatic built-in bias?
Well, it never occurred to me that you should hear them any other way, that they are pollster for one party and the other. And at least as opposed to many of these long, blonde-haired women who appeared during the impeachment and trial of President Clinton, who were identified as former prosecutors, and they had lots of other things to their identity. At least when the pollsters are on the air, as far as I know, the anchor people are pretty careful to say, this is Linda DeVal. She's a pollster for the Republican Party and a very good one and someone that I like to listen to. Same thing for the Democratic Party. So when they're out there in public, of course they are working for their party and putting forward what they think is a position that will help them. It's when they're inside, they're giving the different, you know, ideas and tactics, and that's a whole other story.
You've talked about how politics has changed since the 70s. How has the press changed since then?
Oh, that needs a whole nother book, a whole nother night. There is no question that the press, well, let me do my standard disclaimer. There is no such thing as the media, the press. There are lots of different people with lots of different sets of values, with lots of different sensibilities and ideas about what is important, and that has to be kept in mind all the time. Within that, are there trends? Yes, of course. Has the press, to the extent there is one, become more intrusive, more questioning about people's private lives, more eager to get the scoop, maybe not checking it all that carefully. Yes, that happened, and I use the past tense because I think we're in a new phase where there's a lot of self-examination at these organizations. There's a lot of questioning of how far presidential candidates should be pushed to reveal certain things, and I can't say that I know exactly where it is going. There will always be some who will push to the limits, but I think there's a bit of a retreat, and there has, I know, been a lot of self-examination. There's another phenomenon that's taken place about the media, which is the rise and presence of the cable channels, which contribute quite a lot in some ways. But what they do is impede long thought in the White House and even on Capitol Hill. You know, for better or for worse, John F. Kennedy knew about the Soviet missiles in Cuba and was able to keep it secret for 10 days while he worked out what to do about it. But he didn't have Wolf Blitzer on the White House lawn. And he also, frankly, didn't have the kinds of aides who are thinking about, you know, what kind of speaking fees they're going to get after this. So the more exposure they get, the better. On Capitol Hill, there are some members of whom it is said never get between him and a camera. Now these people have all the more opportunity to do that. I'm not sure they help themselves by always having something to say about everything, but there has been a change in the rhythm of the news. It has intensified. I think of the good old days of Watergate when there was a morning newspaper and there was an evening newspaper. That was a long time ago. And there was the three broadcast networks at night. I mean, it was really relaxed. There were no fax machines. There certainly was no email. And it was now, looking back, a far more relaxed time than when we went through our more recent crisis.
You knew you were going to get this one. How much of a chance does Hillary Clinton have of capturing New York's Senate seat? Does she have Bill's skill at fundraising?
She probably has her husband's skill at fundraising because on that one, they're right in there together. You've seen all these stories of the parties at the Hamptons and other places where the people are represented. And I don't think that's not going to be her problem. There is something of a problem. She has more of a challenge in raising money because the very fact of her running for the Senate has galvanized Republicans around the country to send in money to defeat her. I think she's in for a very tough race. I think it's absolutely unpredictable. I talked to an important New York politician. I'm afraid I can't say who it was, but he knows an awful lot about the state, and he said it's going to get down to whether she or Rudy Giuliani make the more mistakes. And it's early. She has fumbled around a little bit. She certainly does not have her husband's campaign skills. So we have to see how this plays out. It's not a shoe-in. It's not a defeat. It's who knows.
How would you compare President Bush and George W. Bush? Why is it American voters rejected President Bush but like his son so much?
Well, let's wait and see. President Bush was defeated by President Clinton. I think for more than any, if there was a moment when George Bush, George H.W. Bush, lost the 92 election, it was after he had been victorious in leading a coalition in the Gulf War. I mean, his poll numbers were about 91%, unheard of. And he went to Capitol Hill to give a speech, and he'd been advised that now's the time to address domestic problems, and he had nothing to say. And I think that's when it happened. Clinton projected himself as someone with more energy, a vision of the future, and Bush was really not a very good campaigner either. But if you compare the two, when George H.W. Bush ran for the presidency, became president. He had been the CIA director. He had been the vice president. He'd been the chairman of the Republican National Committee and probably other a UN representative, other things I have probably not mentioned. His son is in a totally different category. He's probably a more natural politician than his father. He appears to be looser. But I think, frankly, that the Republican Party is taking a breathtaking chance. They got together, most of them, and governors, money people, and said, you know, it isn't right that we don't have the White House. Republicans really feel that they should have the White House, and they haven't had it for 8 years, and they want it back badly. And they looked around and said, why don't we get together and think of who has the best chance to win it? And there were reasons to go for George W. Bush, or we call him W to save breath, because he had been just reelected governor of a very large state. He had shown a real ability to attract Hispanic votes, which is always one of the groups very fought over in the general election. And he seemed like a likable fellow. When I say it's a breathtaking chance, because and also, of course, he polled well because of the name. Early polls are name recognition and really nothing more. It's a breathtaking chance because he has not been tested. He's not been tested publicly. We don't know, really, they don't know how good a presidential candidate he will be, and this little other matter that I think is important, how good a president he would be. It's an awfully big decision. We will obviously get that chance to see it. But they are extremely different kinds of people coming at it with different credentials. And I don't think that the Republican nomination is locked up. Nothing is locked up until an election over. He is over. He has formidable odds, but he has yet to be tested.
What do you feel about term limits?
Bad idea. There is a need for expertise and experience on Capitol Hill. Actually, the movement has faded, I think, in importance. You don't hear a lot about it. It was defeated in the House. Remember Gingrich's contract with America? It was one of the items. It would have taken a constitutional amendment. And Henry Hyde, who may not have had his finest hour in recent events, but he's a very thoughtful man, and he's respected as truly a constitutional scholar and a true conservative, and he gave probably the most effective speech against it. It's also interesting to note that a number of members of Congress who ran in 94 for the first time on term limits and said that whatever happened, they would limit themselves to three terms in the House, are seeing the light and saying maybe that's not such a good idea after all.
How do you think members of Congress regard letters, communications, from people living outside their districts?
Of less importance than people who live in them, but they pay attention. If they think there's a big national movement on something, they're really going to think about it. This raises the question, which I sometimes get when I say go to the town meetings, to this, that, well, you know, there's not a hope of defeating the guy in our district, or people who in the District of Columbia have really no power at all. And I say, all right, if that's not going to work for you, if you're sure it's not going to work, then there are movements for reform. There are movements for changing things. Join one of them. It's another way of registering yourself with them.
Do you vote?
Nope. Well, if you think that's un-American, I feel so strongly about being journalistically neutral. I don't advocate the election or defeat of candidates, and I don't want to find myself pulling the lever. Now, if I lived in a state where the vote mattered, I might have give this more long and tortured thought, but in the District of Columbia, it does not matter.
There was a time when the sleaze factor hurt a candidate, but are we now at a time when the public perceives all candidates as sleazy, and therefore does this not make a difference anymore?
Well, there's something to that. I think some of us did too good a job of saying the people who are in the system are going to do everything they can to protect it, and that was true. I think, as I said in my remarks about campaign finance reform, that that is no longer true, that there is such a strong movement for it. And a number of people who live with the system now are so disturbed by it that they want to change it.
Okay, alas, we have time for only one more question, and it is this. As you travel about, as you are doing now, are your audiences generally as senior in age as here tonight? If so, what do you make of that?
Well, not really. I've been at some places where there's a mixture, you know, a great mixture of ages. I think it depends on where it is, what time it is, when people get off work. The implication of the question is very important because all the data show that younger people are more turned off of politics than previous generations, and I think all of us have to give a lot of thought to how to get across to them that whether they like it or not, this is their government, and these are decisions that affect their lives, and I just think we have to do a better job of educating them on that. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Elizabeth Drew. Thank all of you here tonight, and thank the audience at home listening on the radio. I now declare this meeting of the Commonwealth Club adjourned.